Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Parents and caregivers of children with disabilities always want what is best for them. Often they are fighting and advocating for their child's success and support within the public education system. With the help of award-winning educator, disability specialist, and assistant principal, Chrissy Kahn, parents can breathe a sigh of relief with her book, Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability. It's an easy read, comprehensive resource in helping to understand the student disability process and implementation with the public education system. Author Chrissy Kahn joins 411 Teen by phone from Baltimore, Maryland. Chrissy, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking with you. What was the impetus in writing Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability?
Well, it's interesting. I've been an assistant principal facilitating IEP meetings for 9 years, but it really wasn't until I was on the other side of the table when I tried to foster to adopt two little girls with disabilities that I found myself wanting to create a resource for parents to help them understand the process and how they can work with the school to best support their child.
Why is it so difficult for parents and caregivers to obtain information about disabilities and available resources?
Well, I think it's so difficult because schools often assume that parents understand the same jargon that they talk in every day, and they don't mean to, but we as teachers and educators, we just throw these acronyms around so often that it becomes a part of our daily vocabulary, and it can be very off-putting for parents when they don't understand that. They feel like things are going over their head, and so often it can deter them from not wanting to reach out to the school or not wanting to look like, you know, they don't know something, and it's just a turnoff right from the start when we're talking in that educational jargon that sounds like another language.
And I would think it might also be intimidating.
Absolutely. And especially for parents, even for me, I was an assistant principal, and when I came to the team table to try to get my youngest foster daughter a 504 plan, it's like 8 people at the table, and you feel very intimidated.
Now, when you say 504 plan, share with the listening audience exactly what that is.
Absolutely. So there are two types of plans. The first is a 504 plan for disabilities. And what that means is the child has a disability such as anxiety, autism, ADD, and they require accommodation, so supports in the classroom to help them be successful in that school setting. However, they are not labeled as a child that needs an IEP because they are not significantly below grade level 1 to 2 years. So they're still performing with their grade level peers. They have that academic capability. However, they still need supports in relation to their disability. So that is a 504 plan that can be implemented and held legally liable for what they need in the school setting.
Okay. Now, that plan can be instituted at any point in their public education career?
Yes.
Okay. As we look at your book, Chrissy, share with us what's different about your book?
So what I wanted to do with my book is, because oftentimes parents have to hire outside advocates, attorneys, to help describe the process, to go to meetings with them, I really wanted to provide an easy, read, something parents could have on hand. They don't have to read it the whole way through first. They can look at the table of contents and very easily see which section they need, so they can be their own advocate and feel confident walking into school requesting what their child needs.
Why do we see, in your opinion, a general insensitivity toward people who are different?
Well, I think we automatically, it's the human condition, what we don't understand, we tend to judge or perceive in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to learn how to be more sensitive to people that have disabilities. So a lot of training I've done with my staff, because, you know, ADD and anxiety, often the kid looks like every other kid, so it's not going to stand out to you. And sometimes educators have thought the child was just being manipulative or they could control it. So really trying to get people to internalize what it's like to have a disability, I try to do that through different activities, professional development, videos, just to get a perspective of what that disability actually looks like in the brain, how it affects a person. I think once we have an understanding, and usually it comes when either someone we love is impacted by a disability or when we ourselves have a disability, you can have a whole different outlook on
it. Well, I'm reminded during the presidential campaign when candidate Trump mocked a reporter doing his campaign. What impact did this have? What was the message that was sent when you're mocking someone who may have a disability?
I think it had a significant impact. If that's like the leader or potentially the leader of our country, which he turned out to be, and he himself is able to be insensitive and make those comments, it kind of made it okay for certain people who already have, you know, that feeling of, you know, segregation, or they're going to be rude to someone they don't understand. It makes them feel like it's justified, and it can never be okay.
Yeah. Well, xenophobia is pervasive, no matter where you go.
Yeah.
What suggestions are, how do parents maintain a positive attitude and outlook when faced with such negativity?
Well, I think first of all, it's the toughest job in the world being a parent, but it is the most important and the most influential. I think first and foremost, you have to make your child understand that they see the world in a different way, that they're unique and special in their own way. And a way I would do that is I tell kids all the time, and I tell parents at the team table, some of the most creative people in the world have had disabilities. I mean, there are lists of celebrities and inventors who all had disabilities. And the reason why they were able to be so creative is because they saw the world in a unique way. It's also teaching our kids how to advocate for themselves and also trying to break this stigma that it is okay to treat people in a certain way. And if we educate children from an early age on in regards to disabilities, especially right now I'm focusing on autism with my students and my staff, and the stimming behaviors that they see, because people don't understand that all the time. And so if we educate them and they learn, you know, why people with these disabilities do these things, how it helps them, then it's not so different anymore.
Well, you're right on time, because I think that's what's happening on Sesame Street at this point.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And it appears to me, and you touched on this earlier, that the more visible the disability, the more difficult it is to cope with it in some ways, and the more intolerance that's encountered. Would you agree there?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If they can see it, then you are ripe for bullying and intolerance. Of course, if they can't see it, then they also have misconceptions about you because they think, you know, oh, you're just daydreaming, you're just being difficult, you're not paying attention. So it can go either way.
It really is a spectrum, yes.
Mm-hmm. What are the variables that influence how well a student may cope with his or her disability?
It's interesting because I was just writing an article from a parent perspective. I was on HLN for an interview recently for this book, and the hairdresser was telling me her personal story about her son who battled in kindergarten. They didn't understand why, you know, he would destroy a room. And she just, you feel like a sense of shame or like you're being judged, you know, looked normal. However, would have these bouts where, you know, he got frustrated and upset and couldn't express himself. So really what's going to help help a child define their disability and have a good year? The teacher. And so right now we're all back to school, and I know every parent with a disability, they're waiting to see, okay, what kind of year are we going to have?
Mm-hmm.
Is this teacher going to get my child, or are they going to try to get my child out of their classroom? And I know I've had several reach out to me already that it's the second one. They're trying to get the kid out of the classroom. And that says that that educator doesn't have an understanding of that child and what they need.
And that indeed also says that maybe their teacher training has failed them, because I would think a component of teacher training would teach you to be at least sensitive to what may appear at that point to be idiosyncrasies or aberrations or anomalies, but at least teach you to be sensitive to that kind of behavior.
I would hope so. And that's what I'm trying to advocate more for within the system, because I have never met a teacher or educator that goes to work and wants to hurt a child or wants to not get a child. Really, it's about the type of training and the type of professional development we're providing from college on. One course in special education and an internship, which is what most teachers get, in a supposed inclusive setting is not nearly enough.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we're talking about disabilities. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a weekly conversation examining issues that impact our daily lives. I've been talking with author and disability specialist Chrissy Kahn. Chrissy, again, what about the school? What role does the school have? Schools have been given increased attention about the issues surrounding diversity, I guess, and intolerance.
Yes. So schools are either going to make or break a child's future. And if you ask any child, or any adult for that matter, they can tell you the name of their best teacher and the name of their worst teacher. And as I was talking about before the break, school systems in general really need to put more resources in providing training for all staff, from bus drivers to cafeteria workers to teachers to administrators, on disability awareness and the best accommodations in the classroom, because oftentimes schools and education itself just assume that everybody knows what to do. And what's happening is more and more teachers are getting kids with different kinds of disabilities, and they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only the schools are we seeing that problem, but I think about police.
Yes. And there was just a couple of stories in the news today, in fact, where an autistic nonverbal autistic person were shot. And then another one I saw today, a 14-year-old, the officer went to put him in handcuffs because he was stimming in a public park.
And explain to the listening audience, what is stimming? What does it involve, and why does it occur?
So stimming happens usually with kids who have autism, and what it is it can be like hand flapping. That's usually the most common. It can also be rocking. And so they do that in order to calm themselves down, but it can be perceived as strange if you have not encountered it before.
Disabled individuals are victimized also at a much higher rate. When we talk about bullying behavior, we find that disabled kids are more likely to be the target of bullying than those who aren't disabled.
Yes, they are. And it because if students are bullied, we have to look at what that does to them over time. You know, nationally, when we look at kids and shootings and even kids and suicide, what happened that led up to that? Which is, again, where schools really need to take an active stance on teaching bullying awareness, bullying prevention, and, you know, reporting.
Well, what do you advocate that we do in the situation with police? Because they are misreading behaviors. There's always an article about a child being, someone being shot, being misread, misinterpreted for their behavior. Where do we go there? What do we do?
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I was thinking about that tonight as I heard a police chief that was commenting on whether the officer in question showed a reasonable amount of force with this autistic child. And as much as I hate to say it, I almost think, especially for nonverbal autistic kids, we might have to have like a certain kind of bracelet or a certain kind of ID, because even though officers are attending trainings, sometimes in the moment, they're not able to determine that that disability is present.
Right. That is the case. So, but I wonder, will they pay attention to a tag on the wrist or something around the neck? Because by that time, the situation has escalated. The policeman is usually irate because the individual is not paying attention to them, and looking around the neck or on the arm does not occur.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part. That's what we would have to get into the training, is what is the procedure, and then unfortunately would people try to take advantage of that procedure. And so it really starts with, so that incident in the park, if that officer would have been able to recognize the stimming from the hand flapping, he wouldn't have thought that child was doing inhalants in the area, which is why he attempted to arrest him on suspicion.
Yeah, and it's often said, well, you need to teach the child. You need to give them effective strategies for coping with when they're being victimized. But, you know, that is not always the case, because they may not be in a situation or at a level where they can engage in effective strategies that are acceptable. And I think that point needs to be emphasized.
Absolutely, it does, because that point assumes that every child has the same IQ and cognitive ability, and that's not always the case. You know, I think an autistic nonverbal child was shot in a movie theater because he wouldn't be removed. You know, again, if officers are being trained with disability awareness, we know that the kids with autism, especially nonverbal, will get upset when they are provoked. And even though it's a big boy, it looks like a man, he's still a boy in his mind.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like in many situations that the key may be early training of the professional, be it the teacher or the policeman or whomever, that may be the key of training them to be at least sensitive and cognizant of these various behaviors.
Absolutely. And with that process, though, systems have to make sure they get the right person training. Mm-hmm. The knowledgeable person, the person that's going to stand up and not just talk at people,
right,
but provide that training in a way that's going to get them to internalize it. So how can we make every person feel like, oh my gosh, that could be my child, or that could be my sister, or that could be someone I love,
mm-hmm,
so they really internalize that training and it's not just something we can check off a list.
What is the first step you would advise a parent take, or a teacher, although I would think they may be different in some ways, when they suspect their child or a student has a disability?
So as a parent, I would always make a note of what I was concerned about. So the symptoms I was seeing in my child that could cause me to think there would be a disability. And then I would schedule a conference with their teacher. That would be my first step, would be to schedule a conference with the teacher and share those observations. In alignment with that, I would also encourage a parent to talk to their child's pediatrician about what they're seeing and see if they have any suggestions, because normally the pediatrician will recommend certain things from the school.
And when the teacher suspects a disability, what's the first step they take?
So when a teacher suspects a disability, they usually will start taking informal data, same thing, on the things that they observe that are leading them to think that child has a disability. They will then try different accommodations or interventions and document how the child responds to those over time. Usually before that happens, they will reach out to a parent and share those concerns, see if they're on the same page, and then they might come to what's called a student support team meeting at the school, and that is with the parent, with the teacher, usually a guidance counselor, a special educator, a school psychologist, and school nurse. And we come and we talk about those concerns.
So kind of a multidisciplinary environment where you have professionals representing various aspects of an evaluation or a diagnosis, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the whole diagnostic process.
Uh-huh.
For parents who may be right on the edge, they're not quite sure exactly what to expect. Uh-huh. What is the process or the timeline that they can anticipate?
So if a parent suspects a disability and they are requesting a meeting, that meeting usually has to be held within 30 days, and they would want to put that request in writing. So then they come together with that multidisciplinary team. We talk about interventions put in place. The team may decide to get permission for formal assessments to determine if the child has a disability. A disability, like we've talked about, autism, it could be other health impairment, ADD, it could be a specific learning disability. If it's an IEP team, which is where formal testing is going to happen, that team is looking for a disability under the codes of IDEA. And that's a lot of what I talk about in Section 2 of my book.
And what is IDEA?
So it is where all the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, all of these processes stemmed from this. And so these specific codes are what we can define a child with a disability under in order to get them a plan through the school system. And that's what the team will talk about. So which disability do we suspect? And then under that disability, how are we going to figure it out? So that's where we get the permission for the formal assessments, the formal testing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's done in school, and so the team members will say what types of tests they're going to do, about how long it will take for each type of test, and then the team will have, if it's an initial suspicion of an IEP, they have 60 days to complete those tests after that permission is signed.
Now, these tests can be pretty extensive and,
yes,
indeed expensive. The financial responsibility, where does that lie? I mean, are parents responsible for this test? Is the school system responsible? How does that work?
So a lot of what parents don't know is, and a lot of parents try to go to outside institutions to get mm-hmm. testing, it's actually free through your
right.
school system. So if a disability is suspected, the school can do that during school time, and it is paid for within the school system because we already have the trained personnel and the testing formats to be able to do that testing.
Let's look at the role of the parent here. What input do they have as far as the steps or the avenues that one will follow in looking at diagnosis? What if you have a child who clearly has a disability and the parents may be in denial or just unable to recognize it, but it is a major problem. It's a problem in school, and it's a problem at home.
Right, and but, often in those cases, though, you'll hear it's not a problem.
Right, I know.
It's just a problem at school.
But once you do a full assessment or you do a home visit, mm-hmm. you see it is a problem at home, too. Now, the parents may not see it as a problem,
right.
or again, they may tend to often offer excuses, but it is a problem.
It is, and that's really, the schools still have a responsibility.
Okay.
So even if the parent isn't in agreement, if through that testing the school finds that child has a disability and could have an IEP, the school has a responsibility to still make that child eligible, to show the parent what a potential plan could look like for this child and recommend that the child get the IEP. Now, the parent has the right to disagree with the
mm-hmm.
school, and they can document their disagreement through a form and through a process. However, what parents need to understand, though, is when they do that, if a child has a disability, then they would not get the type of supports the school is recommending if the parent refuses the IEP.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where do parents go, or what does the school system provide as far as support to aid these parents in really just the comprehension of exactly what's happening? Sometimes, and we talked about this earlier, the parents may feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often parents feel like it's their responsibility, they've failed, they've done something, and that's why the kid is doing this. And that, indeed, is not the case at all. So where can parents go, or what does the school system provide as far as support and advocacy for the parent? Because often parents may need the advocacy.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes there's a disconnect with the team and the parent on both sides. And again, that's where I would like to see a change. The parent and the school team shouldn't be on separate sides.
Mm-hmm.
We never want to make a parent feel like it's their fault. They've done something wrong. A disability can affect anyone. So if a parent is not feeling confident or like they have a resource to go to within the school, there's usually a ladder to go up, so a chain of command. So who is above the team facilitator? you reach out to that person and share, who can I talk to? I don't understand this. I'm worried about my child. Again, there's usually a special ed office within each county that has resource personnel that a parent can reach out to, and there's almost always a law office mm-hmm. within a county as well.
Sometimes we encounter a parent who unknowingly may be overprotective.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address that?
So I think the number one thing with any type of parent is you have to build a relationship with them, a positive one. And so in order to do that, you have to let them know you like their child. You want what's best for their child, and you need to get to know them and why they are overprotective in order to develop that rapport so they're able to hear you. And that takes time. So it takes time, it takes meetings, it takes reaching out, and it takes helping that parent understand what that overprotective level could do to the child later on. But they're not going to hear you unless they respect you.
And that may be where the breakdown comes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, exactly. Honestly, I mean, that is often where we see the system breaking down. Okay?
Definitely.
Because you do.
Because one side or the other, mm-hmm. the other side doesn't respect them.
Mm-hmm.
And really, as a school, that parent knows this child way better than you do.
Yes.
And you're not so righteous in your knowledge. I mean, that's not why we're there.
Indeed, that is the case. May I ask you just to hold your thoughts? We're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Christy Kahn is an award-winning educator, a disability specialist, an assistant principal, and she has just written a book, Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability. She joins 411 Teen this hour from Baltimore, Maryland. Christy, what yes. resources do you recommend for parents and caregivers in understanding and advocating for their child with a disability?
It can be so overwhelming if you mm-hmm. just go on and try to search the internet to find resources.
Indeed.
Again, that's why I wanted to create the book. And so part one of my book is just all about that jargon, those acronyms you can hear in the educational system. Part two is about the actual process. So if you feel your child has a disability, what you can do, the steps you can take, the whole team process, and then what should be in that child's plan. Part three is where I get into the types of disabilities that I see in the public education system the most, ADD, anxiety, autism, traumatic brain injury, specific learning disability. And so in each section there, I have characteristics of what it looks like. Then I have resources for parents, the best resources that I've found for that disability, so they don't have to go on the internet and try to filter through those.
Well, I tell you, I read your book, and I really want to commend you on it. I think it's well written. It's very clear. I think it is not intimidating. Sometimes books like that can be very intimidating. Parents
Definitely.
May not understand. They start to read it, and they're like, oh, let me put this down. This
Forget
is not
it.
For me. Right. Exactly. So, I mean, I thought it was fantastic. I love how you went through all of the acronyms that are often used, because that alone, before you even get any further, you start hearing all these acronyms,
yeah.
and parents are like, well, what is that? What does that mean? That's why as you were talking, I would always ask you to explain the acronym.
Right, because we as educators, what parents mm-hmm. don't realize is we're so excited to learn them ourselves, we just want to throw them out there.
Right. That's true. That is true. So, I want to say thank you for a book that's very helpful and valuable and easy to read.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, you really did a great job on that. As we look at these disabilities, would you talk about some of the more common disabilities, just briefly, and some of the characteristics that are associated with them?
Sure. ADD is probably the most popular one we see and we hear more and more nowadays, and it can look very different. So some kids have the H, the hyperactivity, where they can't sit still and they're fidgeting and tapping their pencil and impulsively touching others. And some kids just sit there and are quietly daydreaming and not processing what's being said. And that's where we need to put things in place to help those types of learners. For example, my county has implemented a learner-centered environment. So what that means is we have flexible seating, so students no longer have to, like, just sit rigid at a desk all day. We have, you know, comfier options. There are, you know, bouncy ball chairs, things like that. And then it's more small group instruction, because what we're finding overall with kids these days, especially with the increase in technology, is they cannot hold their attention for long periods of time. And that is very similar to ADD learners.
Okay.
The second type I see is anxiety, and that often goes hand in hand with ADD. And these kids aren't going to stand up and say, hey, I'm anxious, I'm worried about A to Z. You'll just see them very easily distracted, maybe focusing on worrisome things or things that are irrational, like germs or an order of something on their desk. And so those are probably the top two that I'm seeing right now in education.
Okay. What about the accommodations that we use with these? Would you elaborate a little bit more so parents have an understanding of just how we try to accommodate and the best practices, other best practices in school?
Absolutely. So, again, with each disability, I go through the best accommodations for that in part three of my book. But some can include, for example, a child with ADD, we want to reduce their distractions. So what that means is we might want to give them a study carol on their desk, which is like a little pop-up visual that kind of blocks out what's happening around them. We would want to seat them closest to instruction. We may want to give them a peer buddy or some assistance with organization. Extended time, which means we would give them a little bit more time on their assignments. We would monitor their test response, because sometimes kids with ADD, especially if they're taking a test on a computer and they have to go from the computer to a text, it's very hard to toggle between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to monitor and make sure that they are on the correct question.
How do parents reflect these types of accommodations in their home?
That can be a tough one. When I had my foster daughters, my youngest definitely had ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a constant struggle. And this is where, as a parent, you can also feel judged, because it didn't matter
right.
what we did. I mean, she had so much energy. So building in movement breaks around the house, you know, we had to get a trampoline. I've seen other parents do some more creative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Having a positive incentive system. So, like, my foster daughters had success charts, and they each had goals on them. And so we would reflect and put marbles in the jar at the end of the day. Having a study space and helping with organization. So different things like that But really, a child with a disability at home, you got to keep it interesting and you got to keep it creative because you're always trying to change what you do so the child buys into it.
Now, is there an avenue that, the parent can pursue to get assistance in home accommodations?
That really depends on the school. I mean, of course, within my community, I'm very close with my parents that have children with disabilities. It's really like a family. So I have no problem, you know, giving them some ideas or some things to try at home. For parents in other school systems, they might not have that relationship. Mm-hmm. So maybe looking for a support group online of other parents who have kids with those disabilities, talking to their child's counselor or their pediatrician about any resource or site they could recommend would also be a good avenue.
Okay. Well, we're seeing a lot of mental health concerns. And,
yeah.
You know, reports indicate that there's a rise in mental health issues among our youth. Can you speak to that? What is going on? Why are we seeing this?
I would definitely agree with that. In the past year, I have had more kids, and I work in elementary school, say they want to kill themselves than I have had in my entire 15 years. So much so that I had 2 fourth grade students that were in and out of mental health institutions because their suicidal ideation was that strong.
Uh-huh.
I think it really starts as parents. We have got to have our child be able to talk to us about what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and why. And so in these 2 cases, thankfully, these students were able to talk to us in the school and their parents about why they were feeling that way, their plans. We were able to get them the right diagnoses, which were depressive disorder,
mm-hmm.
the right medications, the right therapies, and they're both making very good progress right now with the plans we have in place. But another aspect of it is, and I don't know if you've seen the documentary, it's phenomenal, it's called Screenagers.
No, I haven't. I'm not familiar with that.
It's fantastic. It was done by a parent who works in a child's hospital, and it talks about brain development and what's happening as a result of our children being on screen so much, especially with that blue light and how it is affecting their brain development.
Mm.
And it is actually making them kind of like what happens to a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
And they're craving that screen like a drug addict would crave a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it is affecting their ability to collaborate with each other, to have those social interactions we used to have as kids. There is a decrease in that. And so it's really affecting kids' brains, which I really attribute to the increase in, you know, mental health.
What about the use of sports? What role can sports play with children who have disabilities?
It's interesting you bring that up because right before we got on the phone, I actually just saw that Aaron Hernandez
mm-hmm.
suffered from CTE.
Mm-hmm.
It was just confirmed. And,
right.
You know, I think it's hard because with sports, especially kids with disabilities, you want them to join sports sometimes because they're lacking the social skills they need to make friends, and you're trying, you know, to get them to learn what it means to be on a team or to make those friends or to have that sense of collaboration. But then I know parents who are also concerned with the types of sports, such as football,
mm-hmm.
because of injuries. And we really just don't know what that does yet to kids and their brain development.
So would you recommend kids playing football when they're 6 and 7 years of age?
Probably not right now. Not with all the studies going on.
No.
In fact, I believe right now they're trying to determine if kids should not be allowed to play until the age of 12
mm-hmm.
or above because of all the studies. And that would be what I would do for my kids if I was ever blessed enough to have them.
Have you seen a difference in the way disabilities are approached, are interpreted according to culture? Meaning, are there any cultural studies that show that different cultures handle or address disabilities in a different way that is really influenced by their culture?
Yes, it's very interesting. So in my community, I have a very, very mixed community. I have an extremely affluent white community, and then I have kids of a different socioeconomic status who are also white on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I also have, you know, a very prevalent black community of all different walks of life. And so what's interesting to me, maybe not so much culturally, but socioeconomically,
okay,
is I've found that sometimes the wealthier the family, the more they want to find some kind of pill or some kind of diagnosis,
mm-hmm,
to just make their child normal. And what I've had to explain to them, especially I had a family that the child has ADD and he has anxiety, and once they got the right medicine for the anxiety, the ADD started flaring up even more. And they looked at me in shock at the end of a meeting and said, "Wait, you mean he'll have these the rest of his life?" And I said, "Yes, he probably will. But see, he doesn't look at that as a negative."
Mm-hmm.
He is getting to know, and he's proud of his disabilities, and he wants to talk about them. But to that family, it's not what's considered normal.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at society, I'm just thinking, do you think that society is obsessed with perfection? And if so, then how does that influence our attitudes about disabilities?
I think society is obsessed with portraying an image of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And a great illustration of that is the very controversial teen drama that's out there on Netflix, 13 Reasons Why. And really, have you seen that show?
I've seen it once. I have not followed it.
Yeah, it's very triggering,
mm-hmm,
for those with mental health issues. And what it does portray is it portrays, you know, the jocks in a certain light, and that,
right,
that perspective we've come to know. However, you know, I think people often try to portray the Facebook image of life. So everything looks so perfect on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But we never really know the battle that someone is fighting. And I've received a lot of negative and positive feedback because my husband and I have put our whole personal story in our first book, Navigating the Road of Infertility, our whole business out there,
mm-hmm,
because we don't have a Facebook perfect life and we want to break that stigma. And I think until more people do, kids and people in general are going to perceive that these beautiful or perfect people are never battling anything, and that's just not true.
Okay. In these last few minutes, first of all, we've been talking and talking and talking about your book, Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability. But where does one get it? Have someone's...
Easiest place. One click and you're done. Amazon.
Okay. All right. Well, that will help. Well, what about those who really may not have access to internet? Because they do still exist.
The bookstores do exist, so there are, unfortunately, mine are only available in the bookstores in Baltimore right now.
Oh, okay.
However, you know, a person's always welcome to go on my website, kingcon.com, and send me a message, and I would be happy to send them a copy.
Okay. In this last minute, any words of wisdom that you wish to share with teachers or administrators or even parents who are out there and listening?
I really encourage all teachers, parents that are out there listening, and kids, let's break down these barriers. Let's not be on separate sides anymore. We all have different growth areas with our understanding of disabilities, and we should be working together to help support the child. It's not your fault. It is no one's fault, but that child has a unique gift to share the world, and we need to help that child grow instead of squashing them down and making them feel they're not worth it.
I appreciate your expertise and your sharing it with 411 Teen. To my listening audience, that's it for this hour. Much appreciation for your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.